Hello, listeners. This is producer John. Open Pike Night is going to be at Trek Long Island 2024. From May 31st to June 2nd, Cameron and myself, producer John, will be in the Big Apple living long and prospering. We'll be hosting a panel. We'll be giving out stickers. We will have our microphones. Be sure to follow Open Pike on social media and subscribe to openpike.substack.com because we also will be giving away some Trek Long Island weekend passes. Trek Long Island is May 31st to June 2nd at the Hyatt Regency in Hopog, New York.
This is Bill Wolkoff, and you're listening to Open Pike Night, the most grappler-forward podcast in the quadrant.
Is this thing on? Hello, hello. Welcome to Open Pike Night, the Strange New Worlds podcast, where your calls are our prime directive. I'm your host, John T. Bolds. With me tonight are my co-hosts, the man who's always singing the praises of Strange New Worlds, host of Sudden But Inevitable, Jesse.
I promise I won't sing anything.
And the man who's excited to cross over from his main show, bringing spoilers from the future, host of Green Shirt and Newbie's Trek Through the Next Generation, Cameron.
Don't you dare besmirch the names of my grandparents. They were scientists.
And our guest tonight, returning for his third time on the Open Pike Night stage, is a captain, a recent Double Strike veteran, as well as a prolific sci-fi TV scribe, including credits for two of Star Trek's biggest swings ever and hits. A man whose lobster claws never interfere with the tying of a necktie. Please join us, welcoming the indomitable Mr. Bill Wolkoff.
They're not sick of me yet, I guess.
Never. Bill, how are you
how
doing?
How could we be?
I'm good. I know this is a podcast, but Jesse, John, and Cameron just saw my son walking in the background, and he just got back from school. And it's just as a brief aside, it's persimmon season right now. Persimmons are only around until the beginning of December. So my son has taken it upon himself to get me as many as possible. And they give them, they're handing them out at the cafeteria. So he just brought me four persimmons that are now sitting by my printer. That was a persimmon delivery.
Excellent.
You're just raising them right.
So the listeners are aware.
I was going to say, first time ever on Open Pike Night, a persimmon delivery live.
A live persimmon delivery. It's very exciting, very colorful.
We did once have Onitra Johnson's sister crawl behind her on camera to get ice cream without making any noise, but this is still a first for persimmons.
Yeah.
He brought enough to share for everybody.
Nice. Good
Much
kid.
Appreciated. So, Bill, the last time you were here, you faithfully predicted that the WGA would have a historical new contract, and it has been lauded as such. First of all, congratulations. And second of all, how does it feel?
Fantastic. It feels like a lifetime ago already, but it's only been a little more than a month. Well, actually, we're closing in on 2 months since we ended our strike. We're taking the long victory lap. It's going to take a lot of time for this contract to be tested out and really trickle down to all of our 13,000 members on both coasts. But we made transformative change, and we knew that we weren't going to get every single thing. When we first started negotiating, we were told 9 of our proposals were never even responded to, total non-starters. We were told we will never, ever get those things. And we got them all. And that all happened in the last 3 days of the strike. So it's a real testament to the power of labor where members really stand up for the value that they create.
As a member of the Writers Guild and Screen Actors Guild, thank you, the new guy. Is that where that credit came from?
I have been a member of the Screen Actors Guild, believe it or not, since 1986. I was a child actor.
Oh, I'm going to have to hunt down some of that information.
I
acted in commercials when I was a little kid. My mother, when I was 4 years old, I'll tell you this brief story, answered an open casting call for a horror movie called The Shining in Chicago. And I was brought to L.A. for a screen test. I apparently did really well, but I was only four. I didn't meet Kubrick. He was in London, but his casting director told my mom, "Okay, so we're gonna play make believe with." She called me Billy, but I go by Bill now. We're gonna play make believe with Billy. We're gonna make believe that monsters are coming down out of the ceiling and trying to get him, and that the walls are dripping with blood and waves of blood are splashing towards him. And we're going to see how that goes. So I'm going to take him your 4 year old into a room alone, and we're going to play all that make-believe. And mom's fine. Yeah. Take him. Cool with me. And apparently I was good at playing make-believe. Obviously I didn't get the part. But that led to me being a child actor, and I was in a bunch of commercials, and I had auditioned for many movies that you know and didn't get in any of them, but I was in a bunch of commercials, and I acted in, you know, high school and college, so I kept, I always paid my dues, and then I was the director's assistant for the movie The New Guy. I wound up having a small scene with Vanilla Ice.
The New Guy. Interesting. Well, now we know where all the emotional turmoil for Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach came from. So. Thank you, The Shining. Well, yes, as a member of both the guilds, how many days were you on strike? I'm sure you've got the number in your head.
Well, it was 148 days for the WGA. It was 118 days for SAG-AFTRA. I think when you overlap them together, I could be slightly wrong. I think it was 197 days.
Okay. Wow.
My math on that part might be off by a day or two. But and SAG-AFTRA, I got to say, Star Trek luminary Jerry Ryan being one of them, and Francis Fisher being another one. Francis Fisher came to TV City, where I was the lot coordinator, on day one of the WGA strike. And I met her there that day. And she came out consistently through the entire WGA strike. You know, they were out, you know, there was a core group of SAG-AFTRA that were heroes, union heroes that really inspired the movement that got us where we are. And I'm proud to know all of them.
So what I'm hearing is strikes work.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
What was it like seeing season two air and everyone talk about it and all the fan celebration for all your hard work while you were unable to talk about it?
Oh my God, it was wonderful and horrible. I had so much that I wanted to say. So much that I wanted to shout from the rooftops. I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, and SAG-AFTRA had very strict rules about promotion. The WGA's rules were a little different. And the reason behind that, writers tend to get ignored in publicity and press. So it's important that writers be able to say somebody wrote this. Paramount has been really good about it. They include writers in their publicity, but it's traditionally the writer gets completely forgotten. The WGA was in, you know, a real bind where on the one hand, they didn't want to do any promotion for the studios and the companies. But on the other hand, they didn't want to push writers further into the background than we already are. So the compromise that they came up with was writers can self-promote as long as it's not at the request of the studio or company. Actors are very visible in publicity, and that's how a lot of the, you know, like, movies get viewers through actor publicity. So they were very strict, no publicity anywhere. And I just wanted to respect that and not, you know, tout the amazing performers who are in the episodes that we did in season two and the episodes that I had the pleasure of getting honor of getting to write. It was a delight seeing our season get well received, and we felt that on the picket line. The fans, thank you, Star Trek fans. We all of us felt your love and your presence, and that kept us going. I'll give a shout out to Claire Willett and the Star Trek Snack Squad. Claire Willett is a fan and playwright who lives in Oregon and organized an army of volunteers who sent regular food deliveries and supply deliveries to Paramount, to CBS, TV City, to Disney, basically to everywhere we had Star Trek writers and performers on picket lines. And there was an army that worked with her, and I'm forgive me, I don't have the names of everybody in the army that she organized, but I want to thank every single one of you that kept us going and was a shot in the arm every time a delivery came, not only for Star Trek writers, but for every writer and actor who was out there for the duration of the this labor action.
Awesome.
Excellent.
Very cool.
Well, we do have a few calls tonight. A couple of them are just pure praise, so we'll start with one of those.
Greetings, Open Pike and Mr. Wolkoff. This is Kelly Zent-Georgi, or Antipodal on Twitter. Mr. Wolkoff, congratulations and best wishes to you and all the writers and actors who stood fast in their long strike against the studios. I'm so proud of you all and very happy that you reached an equitable conclusion. Best wishes for Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 3 production. I think one thing that most fans would like to see is more episodes per season, as long as it doesn't deter from the quality of the episodes. We would also like to see some more short Trek episodes if possible. Thank you, Open Pike. Best wishes during the long hiatus until Season 3 and hailing frequencies are closed.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you for being such a big fan of the show. I Kelly posts a lot about Strange New Worlds, and we appreciate that. Great questions. The nature of streaming, the way the business model works for the networks, they tend to fall to 10 episode seasons. Listen, Kelly, everybody on the Strange New Worlds staff, I think I can say this with certainty, would love more episodes per season. we have many stories that we want to tell, and it would really free us up to explore more areas of the world. It makes us very disciplined. That's one good thing, is that we work very, very hard to make sure we are using everybody as much as we possibly can. But it would be great to have more episodes. I don't know if that's a possibility in the current business model for streaming networks, but that's why. I have no idea why we don't have more short treks right now. The short treks were really active during the infancy of CBS All Access, which is what became Paramount Plus. And I think it allowed CBS All Access to have Star Trek on more times during the year, but still it would be, yeah. Short treks are wonderful. I love, I came into the world, when they stopped being made, and I would kill to get to write and produce one.
They look really fun. I'm going to disagree with Kelly real quick and just say, I'll take some solid sixes if it means we can have 15 episodes per season. Like, please, like, phone it in every once
in a while. Sometimes the sixes are interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can have fun with the sixes, you know? All right. Well, it is time to let you brag about your hard work on season 2. So let's talk about those old scientists. Jesse, you want to start us off?
You really managed to blend the emotionally conscious feel of the TNG Lower Decks era with the more swashbuckling adventurous feel of TOS and Strange New Worlds. Was the balance of tone something that required a lot of maintenance, or did it kind of flow naturally given your modern writing sensibilities?
It was a real collaborative effort, and I want to credit Kat Lynn, who I co-wrote the episode with, and also Henry Myers, our showrunner, along with Akiva Goldsman. But Henry really got in the weeds with us on this one in the best way. And also Mike McMahon. Mike really came, and like we were, it was scary because we were borrowing major characters from another show, that has a completely different tone than ours. And Kat comes from Lower Decks, but Mike, really helped us make sure that we were, not only were we telling a Strange New World story, but we were also telling a story, that was true to Boimler and to Mariner. And we went through many, many drafts in the best way, which happens a lot in TV. Mm-hmm. But when we write lots of drafts, and every other episode has lots of drafts, but double that for those old scientists. And so it took, because it was a big swing, and it took us a while to really make sure we were telling story that was true to both tones. And then, so that was part one. Part two was pulling it off. And that required Jack Quaid and Tawny Newsome, who are not only brilliant voice actors, but brilliant live action actors. Yeah. Amazing dramatic actors too. They have the flexibility to do comedy and drama. And they bring a very different tone with them. And so here's where our cast really stepped up to the plate, because we did not want to drown out their tone. Like for Boimler and Mariner, they were two comedy actors trapped in a drama. And for all of our cast, it was, you know, and they're playful and we do comedy, but it's really a swashbuckling drama with these two agents of chaos let loose in the world. And, our cast met the improvisational tone that Jack and Tawny brought. And we were given the mandate from the beginning from Henry, because Lower Decks is very improvisational. You know, they do a lot of improv to find where you land on, which is what, that's like, you know, like shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm do that a lot. We had a script, but we had the room for improv, and that's not something we tend to do on Strange New Worlds. And our cast really was able to meet that and add to that, but also maintain, you know, the tone in the world that we have. And it took a lot of work, but once we got to the set, we really felt like we had 5,000, you know, drafts to get the right draft. We did not have 5,000 takes. We had just as many takes as we would normally have. And just, we shot the episode in the right amount of time. And what a shepherd that we had, and genius director, auteur director we had in Jonathan Frakes, who's the perfect shepherd to bring this through. So all these elements really came together, and we saw them come together on the set. And it was that was really awesome. That was how we got to match those two tones.
Well, we had a write-in from one of our listeners, David Jones, and you pretty much just answered it about how you integrated live action and animation.
Very cool.
Any roads or bits you went down in those previous takes that didn't make it to the final, but you still kind of enjoyed on their own that you could share?
Anson, boy, did he meet the day. He was such a delight and really brought great moments that I never expected. He had one moment when, at the very end of the episode, when you hear Rutherford and Tendi saying, "Oh, should we come get you?" Yeah. And he goes, "No!" And it took us a long time to get the right, but he had some that were so funny, like some that were very big. And it wasn't that he didn't like them. It was just, I can't go through this again. and I, you know, if there's a gag reel, gosh, I hope we can string together all the videos that he did, because they were great. Yeah.
We hope.
We have a great caller question actually about ad libs here. Here is Abby.
Hey, hey, Open Pike and Mr. Bill Walkoff. First of all, union strong. The last time you chatted with these fine gentlemen, I was telling you how we're a proud teacher union household, and I could not be more thrilled that you guys held the line for as long as you did and got the outcome that you did. I am so proud of everybody who was part of this struggle. And you know what? It works. So bravo. My question for you this time, now that you can talk more specifics, is I know that Trek is famously word perfect from script to screen, but there were some times in a few of the episodes that we are chatting about today, specifically those old scientists, where the actors have said that they improvised. Most specifically, I'm thinking about the Riker on the saddle from Jack Quaid, which might be my favorite part of the entire episode. So I'm wondering how you feel about ad-libbing and what the process is now versus what it used to be, or if it's director and episode specific, and a few more details on that kind of stuff. Because we know that when people who love Trek are on Trek, they can't help but show that love in lots of different ways. So glad to hear from all of you, and hope you and yours are well. We'll talk soon.
First, Abby, teachers are heroes to me, so thank you. Brief strike aside, we had the LAUSD, the LA Teachers Union come out from the LAUSD, and they really taught us how to strike. Teachers do not mess around. That was one of the most exciting days at TV City, was when we had the Teachers Union come out, and they really took over TV City. It was glorious. I'll tell you one tidbit from that scene, because that scene, we made the episode during, I think it was Omicron, or there was another big COVID outbreak happening, and we were beset with COVID during the episode. And Jack's schedule was so tight because he was in the middle of shooting a small movie called Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. Yep. we didn't think we were going to be able to get them back. And then Hero Jack Quaid was able to work it out with Mr. Christopher Nolan,
Mr. Nolan,
to get to get a couple more days to come back to Toronto in the middle of shooting that movie. And then Henry said, "Oh, great. It had to be in the ready room." And so I'm like, what do we get? And we had like 5 minutes to like come up with the scene, and Kat and I are putting our heads together. And we're like, okay, Jack has just Boimler has just left La'an, and he's going to be in the ready room for 5 minutes before he beams down because he needs to be contained somewhere. And we've got that saddle. So he can't resist. He gets on the saddle. And so that scene was written very quickly, like the day before Jack got to set to reshoot this. We had very little time to shoot it too. By the way, what's just getting him on the saddle, like we had to have like a team of prop people come out and make sure the saddle was
strong
ready,
enough to hold somebody, like, yeah,
because nobody had sat on that before. And that was the perfect instance for improv. Like what do you say when you get on the saddle? Man. It was a thing of beauty. When he said Riker, and there were the other things that he said too. That's another great moment of like, we should put in the gag reel all the outtakes from that. But Riker was the best one, and we're like, okay, we got to use that.
Yeah,
man, that blows me away because you cannot tell that scene was at all rushed or not part of the original script. Like it fits perfectly. Yeah. That is very impressive.
That's TV production. I mean, that happens all the time in TV too. You lose actors for reasons, and in the world of COVID, like that makes it even more so. Like we did a lot of writing on the fly. I think Kat and I wrote that in the van on the way to set.
Nice.
Man.
So Lower Decks thrives on loving jabs and starry-eyed references to the Treks of the past. What did it feel like to base those on your own cast of characters?
John, that's the heart of the episode. Yeah. It's like, that was the reason to do the episode. Boimler is a stand-in for, the biggest, he's such a fan of Starfleet that the metaphor is us, the biggest Star Trek fan. So like, what if the biggest Star Trek fan in the world gets to be on the original Enterprise? And so that was our in for the episode. And then you bring in, the chaotic realist about, everything, kind of bring them back down a little bit. That was it allowed us to put ourselves in Boimler's position. Mm-hmm. The moment that when he comes onto the bridge for the first time and he realizes he's on the bridge and you're in his point of view, and Frakes knew exactly what to do to bring us in there. That's us. Mm-hmm. That's the four of us and everybody listening being on the bridge for the first time in the middle of a tense standoff with an Orion pirate who's not really a pirate.
Yeah. Scientist, yeah.
Speaking of being a starry-eyed fan in love with Starfleet and Star Trek, was that your first time meeting Jonathan Frakes? And what was that like?
Yes.
Yeah?
Oh,
man.
Everything you'd want it to be. He, he is beloved for a reason. One of my favorite experiences being on set. He's very open, very inclusive, very collaborative. He just makes it fun to be on set, but he gets the work done. I had to pinch myself several times, but it was a wonderful collaborative experience.
Does anyone ever accidentally call him Riker? Be honest.
I mean, I wanted to call him Riker, but,
So it's a conscious effort is what you're saying.
Well, just looking for writing tips here, how would you write Spock gives the creepiest smile of TV history into a script? How do you format that direction?
Basically, as you just described it. I mean, it was not far off from what you did. I mean, just Spock smiling is off-putting.
Sure.
And Ethan. Boy, does he, he's what's so great about Ethan is he really is able to channel, you know, like he takes the spirit of Nimoy, but it's his own. It's not Nimoy. It's not an imitation. Mm-hmm. He really does inhabit it himself, and he's made it separate from Nimoy. But you still feel, you know, like the honoring of the legacy of Nimoy's Spock. And he's also Spock at a very different time in his life than we meet him in the original series. So he knew how to sell that smile.
If you had to pick one joke from those old scientists that you feel almost, maybe not most proud, but incredibly proud of having written, do you have one off the top of your head?
We do things so fast and furious, like it's hard to, you know, like pinpoint, and it is really a collaborative experience. My way of chickening out of like laying claim to, you know, I mean, I mentioned the, you know, I'm probably most proud of the work Kat and I did, you know, at the very last second, you know, when we had one, you know, set, and how are you going to write a whole scene and really make it funny, and, you know, the saddle, you know, so I think I'm probably, you know, most proud of that.
Good pick.
You know, I could also just take credit for other jokes that I necessarily didn't, you know, write, and, you know, like were
who's gonna
awesome.
Know, right?
So
yeah.
Pick anyone, really, any joke that made you laugh. That's my favorite.
Nice.
Oh,
nice.
Man, that was my favorite too. That's so cool.
Well, then what about non-jokes? Because I think everyone was surprised by how emotional parts of those old scientists are, especially the,
holy cow,
they put that on the poster. That line, I think, I'm getting goosebumps right now just repeating the line. And I don't deliver it as well as Rebecca Romijn. That's right. Was that an intention going into the script? Was like, you know what? We're going to make this funny as hell, but we're going to hit some emotional heartstrings. Or did that kind of just come up organically while writing?
No, we wanted it to be emotional from the beginning. I mean, it's to sustain itself too, you know, and like the laughs have to lead you somewhere too. And there is something emotional behind it too. I mean, it's be careful what you wish for, you know. It is everybody's fantasy to be caught, to be on the Enterprise, but then they're facing an existential crisis of being trapped there. And there is an emotion to that, you know, and like, what are you going to do with your, with your life? And I'm slightly embarrassed that I don't remember if this made it into the final cut. I should know this because I've seen it 5 billion times, but you know, we had a beat in the script that may not still be in it where Jack was talking about, well, if I'm stuck here, I'm going to go to, the island, you know, that, fictional island that they created in First Contact.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, cause like, what else are you going to do? Like, you don't want to mess up history. So like, I guess we got to go there, and, you know, that's somebody that who not only, you know, is a fan, but somebody who feels the responsibility of, you know, being a Starfleet officer and wanting to, you know, not, I might have to make this sacrifice and give up, you know, any semblance of a life that I wanted, in order to, not mess up the timelines. Yeah. So same with the story with Rebecca, like, you know, we had this funny beat, like Rebecca is just so like great at being, intimidating number one. And so it just seemed a natural that, you know, Boimler would be intimidated by her. And we wanted to, you know, we wanted that to feel real and not just like a cheap jab, you know, mm-hmm. just because she's, you know, she is a supermodel. you know, so we took it very seriously, and, you know, we were able to find the joke in that, but also, the real emotion of it too.
Well done.
Excellent. So was there any time during those old scientists or Subspace Rhapsody during scripting or rehearsals where you're like, this is not going to work? Like, how are we going to pull this off? Or was it a ultimately confident experience?
Oh, we were terrified it was not going to work. You know, the day that, you know, we started, I was utterly terrified, but I was set at ease, you know, pretty quickly. We were shooting those old scientists when the series premiered. So we were terrified going in. The first couple of days, the series hadn't premiered yet. And then it premiered. And I think it was on day 3 or day 4 of shooting that we were certified 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And that like was such a relief, you know, like, okay, we're doing, we did something right in season one, and it gave us permission to take this really big swing. All that worked out in the in a happy way. If the show premiered, couldn't have premiered at a better time when we were taking a big swing like that.
Okay, so I can't believe that we forgot to ask Kay Hanley and Tom Pulci about this, but where did the idea for the vocal rendition of the main title theme come from?
I think that was Akiva. I could be wrong. It was either Akiva or Jeff Russo. It was one of the two. The studio and the network were really happy with what we had done. And they, you know, I remember Akiva and Henry said, I think we're going to ask to, you know, the money to do this. And the studio was like, cool. And, you know, they usually don't do that. there has to be some strong arming, but they, you know, they were like, yeah, do it. I was lucky. I got to be on the soundstage the day that we recorded that. It was incredible. It was incredible. I mean, I was crying. It was so emotional.
Very cool. Did you know at the start of the season that you wanted to have Spock take such a large step toward this classic stoicism, or was that something you arrived at while you were developing these two episodes?
For Subspace Rhapsody, Tom went to Toronto while we were still coming up with the story. And he assessed everybody. He like went up there first and like basically said, okay, here are your ringers. Here are people who can sing, but are just, it's not, you know, because we have like people like Celia who, you know, is Broadway star
Grammy
before
winner.
She was a part of our show. Yes. Christina Chong, who is these amazing, you know, is now a pop star. And Rebecca is an amazing singer. And Ethan had not sung before. But Tom said, I think he can. It was like, great, because we're giving him a song. He's got it. You can't have a Star Trek musical without Spock singing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he worked so hard they all did, but like there are actors like Ethan and Anson who are not singers, you know, first and foremost, and they did everything. They were so brave. They trusted Tom and they trusted us to go into an area that was far outside of their comfort zones. And I'm so grateful that they were willing to do that. And then, you know, we have great songs like I'm the X and Status Report and Private Conversation. I'll tell you, I'm going to go off on a little small tangent here. So Akiva came to all of us at the beginning of the season and Henry and said at the very beginning of season two, when we were first blue skying, what we're going to do, they said, we want to do a musical this year. And I said, fuck yes. We all came back in with like, after like we blue sky for like a week or so, usually at the beginning of each season, we all come in with like five pitches that we, you know, want. And, you know, very rarely do these end up being the final ones, but like we, you know, it just helps get the, you know, story process started. And I thought, well, everybody's going to be pitching on the musical. So you got to really pitch on the musical because you got to write the musical. So I went all in on my pitch on the musical and nobody else pitched on the musical. I was shocked. I had some experience doing musicals before on Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts, which is a non-musical musical. Mm-hmm. And Dana Horrigan, who I co-wrote the episode with, she wasn't part of the staff yet. She absolutely would have pitched on the musical I've worked with Dana before on Once Upon a Time, and we bonded over our deep love of musicals back in Once Upon a Time. So when she joined, I'm like, oh, well, I'm writing it with her. I hope. And happily that, you know, all worked out. But in the beginning, the pitch was all about like wanting it to be still feel like a Star Trek episode, still be a full original musical, not a jukebox musical. It was important to me that the science be the cause of why they are all singing. You know, so that's where the idea for the quantum improbability field came in. That it's not, you know, some alien that's forcing them all to sing. If it was an alien, it would feel a little too like magic. You know, I wanted it to feel like really like a Star Trek episode. And like, how do you tie that into the science, you know? And it was about the idea of, I was reading Katie Mack's book, The End of Everything. And in The End of Everything, she talked, which is all about all the different ways that our universe could die. There's a chapter about the heat death of the universe, where after billions and billions and billions and billions of years, particles will, you know, not be able to form, but they'll still be bashing together. But we're talking billions and billions, trillions of years, like so many years, you know, ahead, that particles will bash together, and they, and after enough trillions of years, they will reform in ways that we might not expect. So suddenly, like, a piano just might form in the middle of space, you know. And that was the, so like, they'll inform and they'll just bash together in improbable ways. And for a minute, you know, like, something will completely form. You're like, oh, I'm a piano player. Oh, cool. I'm just playing. Oh no, I'm at the end of the universe. And then the particles, you know, drift off. So that was kind of the initial idea behind the improbability field. And subspace is a great way to, you know, that's a way to do it. Like, rules are different in subspace. Yeah. You can have an improbability field, you know, within subspace where, you know, particles are bashing together, you know, like, in improbable ways, probably a little faster than, you know, trillions and trillions and trillions of years. And, you know, that was our little bit of, you know, science magic to it. But like, it was actually rooted in a science thing. And that stayed through, you know, into the episode.
Yeah. So cool.
So you kind of half answered this, but, you know, after writing Ghosts of Illyria and Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach in season one, were you actively pursuing the more lighthearted concepts in season two? Or, I mean, that's quite a range you've written there between the two seasons.
Not actively. It's just I've done a lot of animation writing in, you know, my my past. So I was a natural for. So that was why I got assigned to those old scientists. I went after, you know, Subspace Rhapsody hard, the musical hard. I, you know, because I love musicals so much. And I, you know, team player, you know, if somebody else had been assigned to it, I would have been champion and done all the work. And like, often that happens, like, you know, like, there's episodes you want to write, and then in a, you know, when you're on a show and like, somebody else gets assigned it, and you know, you champion them, you know, while being very jealous, you champion them. But I got lucky that I got to write two episodes that I was very excited about. One that I, you know, like, just, it was natural for me to have done, and the other, thankfully, I went after it, and they were like, okay, yeah, you write it.
That's gotta feel good,
man. That's how I felt when Cameron and John got to do the press tour with the cast of the show. I was like, really jealous, wish I could be there, but you know what, I'm gonna prop these guys up. And they knocked it out of the park, much like you guys did.
Well, we got another caller here. Newman joining us on the Open Pike Night stage.
This is Newman the Space Hippie from the Movies for Days podcast. Growing up, when I did, it always sort of felt like every Trek was my dad's Trek or my older brother's Trek, and I was always a tourist. And I feel like with this show, I have a Star Trek that really feels like it's mine. It's the show I'm telling other people about. And that's been really exciting, because I have not looked forward to a weekly TV show in a very, very long time, the way I look forward to a new episode of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. So I'm really grateful to everybody who works on that show, yourself included, good sir. Let's imagine you are thrust into a writer's room for a Star Trek show where the ship has a holodeck, and you've got carte blanche to do your holodeck episode. What's that look like? Have you thought about it? Newman the Space Hippie out.
Hi, Newman. Listen, I love holodeck episodes. They're so awesome. I don't know if I'm allowed to like pitch openly, like, what, like, I wish, you know, like, I would love to answer that question. And you know, I'm very proud of, like, we obviously, there's no holodeck. In, there's a recreation room, you know, that appears in the animated series, but we don't have a holodeck in the original series. But we did essentially do a holodeck episode in season one that Onitra Johnson and Akela Cooper wrote, The Elysian Kingdom. And that was, you know, like, I know this is going to sound like a cop out, but that was I felt like, not maybe not necessarily a personal dream of mine, but that's like an example of a great dream episode. Like, Onitra and Akela got to like write a Princess Bride fairy tale type story, you know, with Mbenga as the king. Like, and you don't tend not to see, you know, black characters playing the kings in old, you know, in fairy tale shows. And that was awesome. And I'm just so glad that we get to tell those kinds of stories.
In Subspace Rhapsody, we see La'an gain some new tools and a starkly new perspective. What is something new that you feel like you learned from writing this episode, despite being such a veteran of the craft?
I learned about bravery and comfort zones. This was an episode about going outside of your comfort zone. I learned about the nexus of the two and how careful it has to, you know, you have to be, and how you have to have trust from the people around you when you go outside of your comfort zone. You know, we were able to pull that off with this episode. Everybody on from the top down, you know, Paul Wesley too, who's amazing, but is not one of our regulars and is not with the cast every day, but really became, you know, a part of that big support of everybody. I want to give a shout out to Dan Janot too, who, you know, was so supportive of everybody behind the scenes in Subspace Rhapsody. All of that is, you know, what takes to pull a big swing like that episode off. I'm glad it worked. And it might not have, and it would have been okay if it didn't, because I think we needed to take that big swing. And it takes that nexus of bravery and support. So I think I learned about a little bit about how to achieve that. And credit to Dermot Downes, brilliant director Dermot Downes, for being our champion and our guide through our brave guide through that episode.
Yeah, so we've got one more write-in from Marie. She asks, if you had more time for more songs in Subspace Rhapsody, what would you have liked to include? And I'm very eager to hear the answer to this.
I would have loved to have done a tap dance number on the transporter. We didn't have time for it.
Did you have an idea of who would be involved?
It would have been a La'an number, probably. You know, people transporting in and out, like tap dancing, and, you know, like we didn't have, I mean, we never even came close. I never even made it into the script phase, but like that was something we had talked about, and it, you know, it was just a step too ambitious to pull off. But it was, you know, that was one set that I wished we had been able to put to use in a musical number.
I'm sorry, but a step too ambitious is a great name for that number also.
Yeah, you should name the song that.
Was there any talk of having a Kirk Brothers duet? I think that was the only one where we were like, oh, we would have loved to have seen those two sing off against each other.
Like brother versus brother.
We did. We had yes, I mean, that would have been glorious if we would have been able to get, you know, Dan and Paul to have their own number. But yeah, and that was, by the way, that was a longer episode too. I mean, we went over on that episode. So that was, we were already straining
Understood.
The limits of like how, you know.
just fantasizing about the feature length version. Yeah.
But if anybody earned a little bit of extra time, I think it's you and your team. Cause wow.
All right. Here is our last caller, Mark, returning to the Open Pike Night stage.
Do you hear the people sing? Say, do you hear the distant drums? Is the future that they bring when tomorrow comes. So on that note, it is Engineer Mark here, and welcome to Captain Bill Walkoff on Open Pike Night again. Stating how much I am so amazed by all of your firm devotion to getting done what is right for everyone involved. And I will always be there for you guys and fully back it as much as I possibly can. And on the show side, well, yeah, those old scientists, the crossover, that was so perfectly well done. It could have gone so wrong and it didn't. And then, of course, Subspace Rhapsody. I've already talked to you a bit about that. I adore the musicals and Oh, that was so incredible, especially that clip you shared. That is hilarious and fun. Oh, just so wonderful to see. And looking forward to what we can get next, which I know is going to be a little ways off. But yeah, thank you for everything. Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Engineer Engineer Mark, I think it was his name, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I don't know what the question was there. Was there a question?
Oh, no, there wasn't really a question. Okay. Just praise.
Patented thanks from Open Pike Night. He's one of our biggest supporters, so we figured let's have him voice that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
I'll find a question in there to talk about the wait. Are you able to tell us what filming might take place on season 3? I know there's some dates out there in the ether. I don't know if they can be confirmed.
We're moving very quickly. And we were in the middle of writing season 3 when we went on strike. We've been back. The writer's room is back and people are coming back. I don't know if I'm allowed to give exact dates yet, but it'll be soon. We had not started shooting before the strike, which is fortunate because then that spared us all from being in the awkward position of having to not be on set when our episodes were being filmed. We are now getting the band back together. getting ready to get back, roll up sleeves and get back to it.
Bailing some people out of like Supermax prison. It's like, we need you back.
You son of a bitch. I'm in.
Yeah. Well, speaking of all that, you know, our season 2 one word tease was a very popular segment. So if you would, do you have a one word tease for the upcoming season 3 we can cling on to until we finally get it on our screens whenever that happens?
Oh, boy. I had not prepared for this. I should have gotten myself ready for my one word. All right. Insert Jeopardy music here while I think.
You're taking this seriously. Wow.
Everybody wait. So,
you're good. Yeah.
Everybody wait so long here. I'm trying. Well, it's my fear of like saying something too much, you know.
Right.
Well, last time you gave us go.
I know,
That was so short. We were like, what could this possibly be? And then Spock sits in the captain's chair and says, go. And I got to tell you, man, we all three lost it when that happened. We were like, thank you, Bill. Also, wow, Spock. So it doesn't need to be much, and it doesn't need to have context. Just that single word.
I'm just going to think about like the general feeling that, you know, we have. I know exactly what I'm going to say. Now I'm going to say more Tagus.
Oh! Hey!
You heard it here first.
But I'm going to say more Tagus.
You know us so well. Well.
Oh, man, fantastic. Full circle, you guys. Seriously. Like, come on. Thank you so much, Bill. That was great.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I hope that was worth the build-up.
100%.
Do you have any plugs, social media, anything going on you want to plug real quick?
Plug in the Writers Guild contract, which has already been ratified. SAG-AFTRA actors, all this month, we are members. All this month, there are going to be informational meetings. Go to the informational meetings. Get yourself. There's a lot of controversy out there about the SAG-AFTRA contract right now. I encourage all members to go to the meetings and get informed. 2024 is when IOTSI, and very specifically, I'm going to be selfishly plug the Animation Guild. Their contract is up. And the Animation Guild writers face just as many existential threats, and artists, not just writers, designers, directors, storyboard artists, everybody in the animators, they are facing just as many existential threats as SAG-AFTRA and the WGA did. And the WGA is going to be there for the Animation Guild when, you know, when they go in to negotiate their contract in 24 in whatever form that negotiation takes.
Excellent.
Union strong.
Yeah.
Now I plugged unions. Surprise, surprise.
Gotta stay on brand.
Thank you so much for coming back.
Of course. Like, of course.
Thank your time everybody. Is incredibly valuable, and you help make Open Pike Night just an absolute joy to put together. And so thank you on our behalf, but also all the listeners and callers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, gentlemen. Till the next time, thank you for doing a great podcast and supporting the show.
Thank you to our listeners, supporters, and our 25-minute set Patreon supporters, Steve, Mark, and Pam. You can become a supporter at patreon.com/openpike. Help us keep the lights on and enjoy lots of bonus episodes, videos, commentaries, and much more. Join today. Patreon.com/openpike.
All right. Well, where can people find us, Jesse?
The easiest way to get everything you need for Open Pike Night is to go to openpike.com. There you can find easy ways to record and send your messages, as well as all of our written articles and transcripts of every episode. It's really all right there in one place. Of course, if you'd like to follow on social media, basically any channel you can think of, we are at Open Pike. They're not all actively maintained, but if you message us or talk to us on one of those platforms, we will reply. I promise.
And where can people find more of us, John T. Bolds?
They can find you and I. They can find more of us on Greenshirt, a newbie's trek through TNG, which is your podcast to make up for your failure of never watching Star Trek The Next Generation when we were kids. You're watching it now, and we're recording it episode by episode. It is fun. It is irreverent. And yeah, there's a lot of dick jokes.
We track every dildo-shaped prop TNG is thrown at us.
Yes, we do. We absolutely do. And if you go to openpike.com, be sure to sign up for our newsletter so you know who we're interviewing next so that we can hear your voice on the Open Pike Night stage. We have Dana Gasparin up next, who is our first Star Trek Strange New Worlds editor. And I think that's going to be a great interview.
Very excited for that. I've done my fair share of video editing, so going to geek out fully on her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's going to be some very editing nerdy questions coming up.
And she has quite the editing resume, perhaps unsurprisingly. There is probably something on her IMDb that you have seen. And she was a production assistant on The Dark Knight Rises. Like, that's pretty big. Like,
All
roles are big, and that movie was huge. So, yeah, definitely get ready for that. And, of course, as John mentioned, if you'd like to sign up for the newsletter, there is a link on our website. But if you prefer to just go directly to it, that is openpike.substack.com. Yes, it's on Substack, but it is totally free.
The Open Pike Night crew has to go sit around and consider what Bill's one-word tease could possibly have meant. What could Mortegas mean? What could it mean for Open Pike Night? So be sure to clean up after yourselves. Be sure to tip your servers. You can go anywhere you want, but you can't stay here.